Radio City once again at it. John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you, talking over the world of pop culture and whatever else happens to occur to us. And Rob, how's everything going in New York City?
Not too bad. It's brutally cold. Seasonably, though. I mean, you can expect it. We're now in December. And an interesting little thing to start the show with. That mild snowstorm from a couple of weeks ago had its first fall guy. The head of the emergency, the Office of Emergency Management, who really should not have been held responsible for the major fuck-up that occurred when the roads weren't cleared and people couldn't get to and fro. And de Blasio didn't even have the courage to tell the guy. He let him twist in the wind over the span of a weekend. The person who should have taken the fall was the head of the sanitation department, and she's managed to skate away on this one. But yet again, New York City has fallen prey to a completely incompetent mayor. Even the liberal Daily News has turned against him, referring to him as, and I kid you not, Mayor Numbskull.
You know, that's probably about the best moniker he could have hoped for out of them, because it could have been a lot worse. We got about the same kind of weather going on here as you do there. We got a little bit of, a very, very light dusting of snow over the last 48 hours or so. And it's fine. It's still hanging around in the, the shaded portions of the yards and things like that. But it was bad enough that it caused some really nasty wrecks on Tuesday morning. But today's commute was a little bit better.
Well, the thing is, here, you wait 2 weeks and then you decide someone's going to be a scapegoat?
Yeah, right. Oh, I understand.
And the fact is, that's completely on the head of sanitation, because all the sanitation trucks were loaded and ready to go with salt and sand, and they had to wait for word from the mayor, which never came. So...
You know what the great part about that is for me, though, watching it from the outside, is that it reminds me again that it doesn't make any difference how big your town is. Local government is just screwed up. There is no way. It doesn't matter if you're talking about New York City or Waterloo, Illinois. Local government is screwed up.
I could not agree with you more, sir.
Love it. Well, we've got a whole bunch to talk about. Lots going on. And last time we talked, the Sabres had just put the finishing touches on a 10-game winning streak. And we said, oh, they're looking for the record with number 11 at Tampa Bay Thursday. And what happened to Tampa Bay? They got beat. And then they got beat again at Florida. And then they got beat again at Nashville the other night. And now they follow 10 games winning streak, a franchise record tying streak, with now a 3-game losing streak that they're going to try to snap as we speak in Toronto.
Well, it goes to show you, I'd said that the Rangers had the best record in hockey since the beginning of November.
Yeah.
All of that's been negated because I think they've lost 7 in a row. The most appalling of which was this past Sunday night, which was a ceremonial. There was a ceremony beforehand. Vic Hadfield, who was the captain of the Rangers when I was a kid, my Rangers – that I grew up with and loved, and that's what turned me into a Rangers freak. They were all there. Brad Park, Jean Rattel, Roger Gilbert, Walt Kachuk. They all were there for the raising of Hadfield's number 11 to the rafters. The Rangers were up 3-0 late in the third period against the Winnipeg Jets. And what do? Of course, give away all 3 goals and lose in a shootout, because naturally, if Lundqvist is in net for a shootout, they're going to lose.
Right. You can't count on anything.
You want to torture me the best way possible? Rangers lose Sunday night. The Jets, who had a 16-0 lead at halftime, managed to lose to Tennessee in the last 3 minutes of the game. I think it was 26-19 was the final score. Just absolutely appalling.
And the Bills, oh God. I mean, they had every opportunity, including the last play of the game, to win that game at Miami, which would have been – for Josh Allen coming back off of the arm injury and all of that stuff, would have been a really nice way for him to put the first nail in whatever his legacy is eventually going to be in Buffalo. But the throw from about the 33-yard line came up a yard and a half short and fell harmlessly in the end zone. And, because of that, that was on fourth down, I think. And Miami ended up winning the game. But it was close enough. It was a good, exciting game, and it came right down to the last play. But like always, Buffalo ended up on the losing end of it. So now here we are at 4. I guess the best we can do on the season is going to be 500 ball, 8-8. Yeah, because they're at 4-8 right now. And I don't know. I don't know what to make out of this team. It's just, time to close the curtain and wait for next year.
Well, I'll tell you what's so upsetting is the fact that the Jets were doing everything right. I mean, 16-0 by halftime.
Yep.
They had the Titans shut down. defense was on fire. But of course, with all the passes that they got, and it was McCown in at quarterback because Darnold's hurt. You know, defense and offense were firing in all pistons, but in the second half, of course, they could not score a touchdown. It was all field goals.
Yeah, right, and that kills you. You can't, in today's NFL especially, with the ball flying around like it does, you cannot kick field goals and win football games. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go out and do something different on Sunday, i.e. anything but watch football.
Fair enough. A bunch going on today, and we're going to kind of work backwards on this because the funeral for George Herbert Walker Bush is today and tomorrow. And George W. Bush delivered his eulogy for his father today, a very moving, very touching kind of speech. Donald Trump was there. He was in the front row of pews, sitting right next to, well, it went Donald Trump on the end, then Melania, then Barack Obama, then Michelle Obama, then Bill Clinton, then Hillary, and, you know, and on down the road. And it was interesting to see what their reaction to him was, because he doesn't like to be in their company much. It's one of the few tells that he has that he really understands on some level just how out of his depth he is, you know, because he did shake hands with Barack and Michelle, kind of, and he got the idea from them that the reception was not great and didn't even look at the Clintons, and they didn't look at him either. Bill kind of, you know, kind of shot him a sideways glance, and that was about it. But you know, the fact is, you can't act like that kind of a dickbag for that long to everybody in that row of people and expect them to say, hey, you're president, come on in.
Especially with the fact that they were all actual presidents.
Yes, right, exactly. And I mean, he's what he is.
And you can also add to the fact that, of course, Bill Clinton had a wonderful relationship with Bush 41 and right. has a great relationship with you know, W. And the same can be actually said for the Obamas. You know, I mean, you can make of it what you will and say what you will about George Herbert Walker Bush, but he certainly seemed to have that way about him that he embraced everyone that he brought into his circle and made them feel like family. And that included the Clintons and the Obamas.
Right.
So, you know, you have to admire someone with that kind of human touch. He was not a good president. He failed the job miserably, unfortunately, and you know. But he was, I think, a decent enough person.
Yeah, it's funny because we may now have to recalibrate what a miserable failure as president means. Well, so he may end up looking better over time.
Put the asterisk on the Trump presidency, which I think everybody collectively should.
Yep.
41's failure was the fact that he did not take heed to how the economy was going at a time that he was celebrating his popularity because of Operation Desert Shield / Desert Storm.
Yeah, and a lot of the shine was starting to come off that. By Election Day in 1992, there were already some real cracks starting to show in the lead up to the war. So people were getting it by then. And that, you know, between those two things and a couple of other kind of smaller issues that were going on, there was no way he was going to win that election. And what I think served him the worst in the lead up, in probably the last 2 weeks before the election in 1992, is he had so many people around him telling him he was going to win. And I think that hurt him because I think that he stopped campaigning. I think he wanted to just coast through, get the election over with, and get on to his second term.
The other thing is the two other big factors I think that were problematic for him was Ross Perot.
Yep.
And James Carville saying the magic words, it's the economy, stupid.
Yep.
Nobody listened on Bush's side, and it cost him. But you know what? I think time and history has been a lot kinder to him because he only served the one term, and I think he was very good behind the scenes and quite instrumental helping Clinton along.
Right. And without the criminality involved, he was, you know, there were some lines that you could draw through to about the middle of Nixon, because Nixon was shaping himself up as a very, very competent foreign policy president, while his domestic policy he was totally clueless about, and he had no idea what an economy was. So, you know, if you only look at him from that standpoint, you know, you take the war away from George Herbert Walker Bush, And from a foreign policy standpoint, he navigated the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the East Bloc and the reunification of Germany and all of that better than I think a lot of people would have.
He was a very fine diplomat. Right. I mean, he was a refined diplomat.
And because of his time at the CIA, he got it. He understood it.
You know, the first time I remember hearing George Bush's name was when Jimmy Carter failed miserably with that attempted rescue of the hostages in Iran.
Right.
And 79. And Bush was the only one who spoke in Carter's favor, which you didn't do. And there was no need to because Carter was such an awful president. Really, right. You know, you want to talk about an awful president, hence only one term. But Bush was very eloquent in his defense and trying to explain why Carter's attempt at doing this was the right thing to do.
Yep.
You know, and that gave me a sense of respect for him. I kind of hoped that he was going to overtake somebody like Ronald Reagan, who I couldn't stand. But of course, naturally, he became the number two guy. So. But
right. Well, the one last thing about that is that if you want to look for a connection between Jimmy Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush, it's the fact that both of them had not just successful but stellar post presidencies. That world is got to be, again, it's a very tough one to adjust to, you know, being the leader of the free world and then just being some guy again. And both of them did that very well and acquitted themselves well. As human beings and as humanitarians.
Yeah, I mean, 41 definitely stood out in a very, you know, again, in a very refined manner as being humanitarian and doing charitable work. And you know, it was to his credit. I mean, certainly, you know, we still revere Bill Clinton as president. Let's not beat around the bush, no pun intended. But, you know, he took a lot of cues from George Herbert Walker Bush.
Sure.
And that's to his credit because he learned. He learned from somebody older and a little bit more seasoned. And it gave Bill Clinton a lot more polish, you know? And as far as
– I got 8 jokes in my head right now, and I'm not going to say any of them.
I'm sure you do. But, you know, as time is going to turn opinions to a degree, I'm sure, you know, comparing – apples to bananas, you have Bush 43 and you have Donald Trump. Which one do you like better?
Right. And on the Donald Trump front, we may as well jump right into this from there. And we'll see. I mean, we'll talk a little bit more on the next go round about what the second round of eulogies and everything else for George Herbert Walker Bush is, because we just don't know yet. That's all going to happen tomorrow. But on the Trump front, it's fallen apart. And I know we've said this before, but it seems that every week and almost every day that goes by now, the pace accelerates. We had another guilty plea from Cohen. We had Manafort go back on his. But even more interestingly than that, you had Michael Flynn, who now, from Robert Mueller, and this is such a great trolling move on Mueller's part, Mueller recommends that Flynn not get any prison time, even in light of his guilty pleas, and puts out this redacted memo that says, we got a lot of information from him on, and then 27 lines of redacted black mark. So all Donald Trump can see, presumably, are those redactions, and he doesn't know what Flynn said. Interestingly, a lot of the buzz today seems to be that what Flynn did was flip, but not so much on Donald Trump because they've already got him. He flipped on Mike Pence and is ready to, or through his whatever testimony he gave in those 9 hours to Robert Mueller, he threw Mike Pence right into the mix here, which is something we haven't heard yet. So whatever bombshell is about to go off, it may take all of them down.
Well, let's not forget also this debacle with the Khashoggi case.
Oh, God, such an embarrassment.
It is, and I do find it interesting and a little strange that, you know, this has happened before, and yet we never hear about it all that much, and now this is getting the spotlight for everything. And I saw, who is the secretary, the current Secretary of State? What's his name? The rotund fella.
Shit, here we go again. Hold on.
There were two two defenses of this. Well, there's no smoking gun. But of all people, Lindsey Graham came out, no pun intended, today to say, oh, there's not only a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw.
Pompeo.
Right. Thank you. And Corker even said, no, this is completely at the hands of the Saudi government.
Right. Yeah, and everybody has. I mean, like you said, Lindsey Graham and how many others have come out? Paul Ryan, everybody in government who has any connection whatsoever to the intelligence community says, we don't need a smoking gun. We know who did it.
The most important thing, though, is that the woman who's now the head of the CIA told the senators, no, the CIA found that.
Yep.
Rather than going through the machinations of spin and BS that, you know, Trump's people have been doing, you know.
Go ahead.
No, no, and she completely contradicted them, which praise to her for doing that.
Right, and
you're doing your job.
The important thing about what Lindsey Graham had to say is that he brought it back into political terms and really was honest about his own perspective on this, which is, if you really want to lose the next election, keep this shit up, you know, because he said, if I were the Democrats, I would be all over this right now. And sure enough, they will be if any of them can find their spine.
No. You're giving them way too much credit. Yeah. Right now, the Democrats are busy tripping over their own collective dicks.
As always.
As to who's going to run in 2020. And now you've got Joe Biden saying, I'm the most qualified to be president. I mean, this is a pandemonium shit show.
Yep.
To paraphrase from the late, great Harry Nilsson. You have so many names. There are about 30 people out there saying that they're going to run for president. None of these people are worth a damn.
Right.
None of them.
And two of them just lost elections. I mean, they're talking about Beto O'Rourke and Gillum from Florida. And they both, what do they have in common? They just got beat. Good call.
Yeah. And of course, you know who is, you know, lurking about, spitting forth that, you know, he's going to run. You know what? Just die already.
You mean the aardvark?
Yeah, he doesn't have enough class to be the aardvark had more brains at least. And more charm, you know, this guy isn't. He's just a ghoul. You know, he's like the guy that used to go around at shul all the time. You know, he was sort of like the Seamus at the shul, going around trying to get, you know, everybody to contribute their pennies to the little box. You know, the contributions box. It's like, well, you go away. We're already members. We're not giving you any more money. Get out of here.
Exactly. Yeah, just leave me alone. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no cohesion to any of it. None of it makes any sense. And nobody, you know, it's amazing to me how short memories are, because nobody understands or remembers that, you know, when Barack Obama and before him Bill Clinton started their runs, they didn't just come out of the woodwork. They distinguished themselves through their campaigns and through their actions. And nobody's doing that. They're all just going, well, I'm good looking, you know, or I came close. Oh, come on, really? That's the best you've got? And then, of course, you got Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, who collectively are 470 years old.
Well, two things. One, I remember very clearly the very first time I heard the name of Barack Obama, because it was when he was going to make the keynote speech during the half-witted ascendancy of John Lurch Kerry.
Yeah.
I remember hearing them say, because it was on, do you remember Air America?
Sure.
When that was the thing. I remember hearing on Air America how somebody was saying, mark my words, this guy could become president of the United States. And that was summer of 2004.
Yep.
So that was a full 4 years before he ran for president. As you just said, they didn't just come out of the woodwork. Groundwork was laid out, you know? That's number one. Number two, I've made this observation, and I think it's a pretty good and strong one. Disciples of Comrade Sanders are like Scientologists, except Scientologists only go after each other.
Right.
You know, they don't wield power anywhere except in Hollywood. The problem with these motherfuckers, and I'm talking about, you know, the communists.
The Bernie bros, yeah.
Yeah. The Sandinistas. They're the ones who go after everybody, and they try to destroy everybody's names and lives. And nobody seems to be putting a stop to them.
Nope.
And these assholes, even though they don't seem to do it because none of their people ever win, they allegedly vote. So this is a bigger problem than anybody seems to surmise. I have this very bad feeling, not so much bad feeling because I'm no longer a member of the Democratic Party, but I have a feeling that they're going to take them lightly again, which is why Donald Trump is going to win. Now, look, when somebody like Bruce Springsteen says, at this moment, you don't have anybody that can beat Donald Trump in 2020, you listen.
Yeah, but they won't.
He's Bruce fucking Springsteen. Right. Once the guy said something completely accurate and to the point, listen to him.
Yeah.
He's not saying this in a lighthearted manner.
Not only
There's
that.
No quality here.
Right. Not only that, but think about it for just a minute. Is there anybody in the pop culture world who knows how to talk to the people that lost Hillary the election in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin better than Bruce Springsteen?
The answer is no, except none of these assholes are listening to him because
right.
they look at him like they look at everybody else, the old guard, you know? But meanwhile, they'll be listening to a drip like Michael Stipe talk about Bernie Sanders.
Right.
How's that working out for all of you people?
Yeah. Well, the Democrats are in the same mindset right now as Donald Trump is, that all we have to do is play to our base and get them to show up on election day. Yeah, right, but you don't know how to do that. Bruce Springsteen knows how to get them to spend money to go see him in concert for the 40th time. Listen to the man.
As it's been said very wisely several times during the span of the week, don't think you're going to be able to out-Trump Trump.
Exactly. Well, let's get on to some fun stuff because I know you've been watching some new TV. I've been watching some new TV. There are actually some fairly exciting things going on the tube now and finished up the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000. They're all great, but I was going to say that anyway. So watch those on Netflix. But what have you been looking at?
Well, the thing that we discovered was this, I guess it's a miniseries called Escape at Dannemora, which of course is a true story, the escape that happened in 2015 from Dannemora State Prison in upstate New York near Malone, New York, near the border of Canada.
Two very, very bad human beings. Yeah, I remember that well.
And a woman who worked in the prison basically had helped them escape. We know the story, you know, one of them was caught. He's going to be doing life plus 7 extra years for his escape. And the other one was shot and killed by the police. I believe she was sentenced to do 3 years for aiding and abetting. But this miniseries, by and large, it's good in the sense that you've got some real talents in there. You know, Benicio del Toro, Paul Dano, and Patricia Arquette, who are fantastic actors across the board. You know, the story itself is very straightforward, very dry. There's no real room for any kind of funny stuff, if you will.
Yeah.
The only problem is it's directed by a total hack, Ben Stiller.
He didn't do well, huh?
He never does well. But here's something that we're going to have some fun, genuine fun with, because this is not a rebuttal. This is a counterpoint or counterpiece to you, because I saw Bohemian Rhapsody Saturday night.
Oh, well, by all means. What'd you think?
As the general consensus goes, I am in complete agreement. The acting was terrific. I actually really found the performance by the guy who played Brian May to be stellar.
Yep.
And I found it funny that the fellow who played John Deacon is an American actor from New York, actually, and he looks just like John Deacon.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic and uncanny. I had no idea until the very end that that was Mike Myers playing the cliched British record company executive with the curly Jufro and the beard and the aviator frames. But as far as the script went, I thought it was campy, not in a limp-wristed campy way, but, you know, campy, cliched, and stereotyped. It was just too much of exactly what I suspected it was going to be.
Yeah,
I hated the fact that nothing was linear in terms of time frame, because, again, you and I and many, many people have seen enough documentaries about Queen and about Freddie Mercury, and I was genuinely offended with some of the liberties that they took. Freddie Mercury did not tell the band right before Live Aid that he had AIDS.
Right.
He wasn't diagnosed until a year plus afterwards, in 1986. When he told the band, it was in the studio, and he simply said to them, because most people know exactly what his words were, look, I've got this thing. I don't have to tell you what it is. You already know. I don't have much time. I don't want to talk about it anymore than this day. All I want to do is make as much music as possible while I'm still here. So we're never going to talk about it again. And that was it.
Right. And how do you get that wrong? You know, how in good conscience do you get that wrong in that movie?
That whole thing with the Live Aid thing and you know, making it like they hadn't seen each other or talked to each other. No. They had just released the Hot Space album. No, sorry, not Hot Space. The Works. In 83, Freddie Mercury put out Mr. Bad Guy, which was an abysmal failure. I remember we could not move a copy of it when I worked in the record store. Nobody bought it. They were already starting to plan work on what would become A Kind of Magic, which would come out in early 86, which would lead them to play the biggest show of their career at Nebworth, reestablishing them as Britain's premier band. You know, it was a very poor script. And I love the fact that they went from recording Bohemian Rhapsody right to suddenly they're doing Fat Bottom Girls. Sorry, but you know, you did have major hits with Somebody to Love, Tie Your Mother Down, and oh yeah, what's that song called? We Are the Champions. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you make the leapfrog from 75 to 78? You know, and by the way, he did not meet Mary Austin and the band on the same night. He already knew those guys from school.
Right.
And he knew Mary Austin because she dated Brian May first. Again, that's sloppy. That's not even good fiction writing.
Yeah.
Liberty taking with historic figures in this case does not wash.
No, so, I agree with you entirely.
You get a C-minus from me.
Fair enough. Well, in the one thing that we caught on to just over these last couple of days, because Michael Douglas was on, I don't remember which late night show, probably Colbert, over the last week or two. And I saw him and saw that he had done this thing for Netflix, I think. Yeah, I'm almost positive. It's either Netflix or Hulu, but I want to say it's Netflix. And I didn't know what it was, had no idea. And then the other night we opened up, it is Netflix. We opened up Netflix and there was the ad for it. And I saw that not only was it Michael Douglas, it's Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. And it's called the Kaminsky Method or something like that. The idea is that it's patterned after the Actor's Studio. Okay. And Michael Douglas is the acting coach. He's the Lee Strasberg character. And of course he sleeps with all of his students and all of this stuff. And what it really is it's a buddy picture with Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin figuring out what it is to be old guys.
You got to fix that. Old what guys?
Old Jewish guys. Exactly right.
Come on.
Hey, they're doing the Two Live Jews routine. Waving. So it's that story. And it is pulled off so beautifully. And the thing is, okay, Michael Douglas is fine. And all of the supporting cast are fine. And Alan Arkin is holy shit. Unbelievable. Now, Alan Arkin's always great, you know? But there are moments in this thing that, I mean, I said this, I wrote a post on this on Facebook, that the first time you see him in the movie, it's probably a good 2 minutes into the scene before he says anything. Before anybody says anything, he's in this little, it looks kind of like the Russian tea room, only I think this is supposed to all take place on the West Coast, but he's in this little Russian tea room kind of establishment, and there's a waiter who is 20 years older than him, who's bringing him over his martini, and the guy's barely moving, and he's got the martini on the little tray, and the look on Alan Arkin's face as this guy is trying to make his way across this restaurant is classic, and I was laughing out loud before anybody said a word. It's that good. And Alan Arkin is that good in this thing. So you got to watch it.
Two words. Gestapo tactics.
Yeah. I'm hungry. I want a taco. Everything. I mean, the guy is so good.
I mean, look, Glengarry Glen Ross is one of the greatest American films, bar
yes.
none.
Yes.
Arkin is priceless, even though his character is kind of one of the minor characters. Just the few minutes when he's becoming completely unraveled because he's such a schlemiel as it is, and he's being grilled by the cops, and he's just yelling Gestapo tactics throughout the whole thing as they're leading him into the room just to talk to him.
Right. And he didn't do anything.
Right. Did you do anything? No. Did you rob anything? No. Then what are you worried about? It's Gestapo tactics. I'm telling you. Take it easy, George.
Yeah. So yeah, if you have any interest at all in that kind of thing, it's classic. And I mean, they're playing guys who are 25 years older than me. Look, so, you know,
you got Michael Douglas. Do I really have to say anything more about Michael Douglas? We all want to be Michael Douglas when we grow up, because
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Catherine Zeta-Jones. You get Sharon Stone in the movies. I don't care how old she is. That woman is just, she's still so good. She should be continued on the next girl, you know?
Yep.
Do we really have to go down the list of all of Michael Douglas? Oh, God, Kathleen Turner when she was a woman.
Yeah, there you know? You go.
Jesus Christ.
When she was a woman.
Have you seen and heard her lately?
Yes, 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 I know.
Hi, Daddy. I mean, come on, that's just really painful. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here's one little set, because we're going to non sequitur from topic to topic, folks, because we want this to be a fun show. We don't want it to be too heavy-handed, but there is one little piece of me that we all lost in the New York area recently, and that was Bleecker Bob himself, Bleecker Bob Plotnick, who was not exactly the warmest and fuzziest guy on the planet. He was never a dick to me. But basically, he was a dick to everybody. He always had something to say whenever you went into Bleecker Bob's. Now, you can say what you will. The only time he ever got a little snarky was I'll never forget, because I would go in there regularly. That's where I get my brand new singles by The Jam as they came out from the airport and were delivered right out of the box. I kid you not. And I was in there one day getting one, and he looks at me and goes, "You're always in here buying The Jam. Why don't you buy some of the other mod stuff?" I said, "What, like Secret Affair?" And he liked the fact that I shot back with that. And he goes, "No, not the 79 bullshit. Stuff like The Action or The Creation." And I unzipped my jacket, and I was wearing a homemade Creation t-shirt.
Nice.
So, you know, he's like, "Where'd you get that?" I was like, "We actually made these." He's like, "Good for you. Good for you." You know what I mean? Like, skulked off to abuse somebody else. So, Bleecker Bob's was not the best record store, but it had an ambiance to it. I preferred the original Bleecker Bob's that I used to go to, which was not the one on West 3rd Street that everybody remembers. It was actually located on McDougal, right near the corner of 8th Street. It later became a barbershop. It had this really cool metal spiral staircase that led upstairs to where you'd get t-shirts and, you know, your punk gear. Downstairs was really cramped, really tiny, smelled like somebody took a piss right on the rug.
They probably did. But
It had a vibe about it.
But you know, that rug really tied the room together.
Don't do that. I am surrounded by people always raping and pillaging from Lebowski.
I know.
The next person that says, "I hate the fucking Eagles," I'm going to punch them out.
I'll stay away from that one. But yeah, that is sad.
Pray to God.
Anytime you lose somebody like that who is such a fixture, and a fixture in time as well as a fixture in a certain place, yeah, that always hurts.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad because, you know, it nails another part of my youth shut. Nothing lasts forever. I know this, but just watching everything go, it's like watching slow motion of dominoes fall. That's what it is, because when I walk through Greenwich Village now, I don't see any of the Greenwich Village that I knew. You know, there's nothing historic about it anymore, really. It's just a tourist trap now, and it's cheesy. That's the worst of it. You know what's left from when I was a kid? Puerto Rico Coffee Company.
Yeah.
That's the only place left from when I used to go hang out there on a regular basis, you know? And if they go, man, that's the end of the village, because there's nothing left. Everything is closed. Kenny's Castaways, where we used to play, Circle in the Square, all of the record stores, you know, just everything. Every restaurant that we used to go to. When we would play, when 2 Minutes Hate and then subsequently The Punchline in our first few gigs, we'd play in the city, we would always go to Cafe Le Figaro on the corner of Bleecker and McDougal. And we'd always go in and we'd order the same thing every time, because it was like a celebratory post-gig meal. Always going to get the fantastic ratatouille casserole and cappuccino, because they had great food. And we reassessed the show that we had just done. And even that's gone. And one of my favorite pictures in the world is of The Loving Spoonful in 1965 in front of Cafe Le Figaro. You know, so that's show. Look at the lineage there. The Spoonful, 2 Minutes Hate, and the Punchline in 83. I mean, all of that has just been wiped away.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I don't feel any sense of anything towards New York City anymore, because that was my stomping ground. On the flip side of that, the beauty of it is I am very fortunate to have been born when I was born, because I was able to partake in the Village in its second act, if you will. You know, the folk years were the first boom years, of course, but then the punk era and the new wave era of the late 70s into the mid 80s was equally just right and ripe. So I had that time. So, you know, it's just another thing consigned to memory that Bleeker Bob himself is now gone.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there's a couple of things that have gone on a personal level over just the last 24 hours. I don't know how much time. I mean, I know you spend a lot of time on Facebook, but are your social media pages open to everybody? Do you care who comes by and looks at your stuff?
Oh, yeah, I do, actually. I started kind of refining it so that way not every dickhead on the planet can start sending me, you know, invites to like their band and you know, like Land of Goshen or whatever the hell it is. I mean, it's ridiculous things that I get.
The only reason I have a very limited number of people that I have banned off of my Facebook page, and I added another name to the list today because really, I don't care what anybody says about me. You know, if I had that kind of thin skin, I would never would have lasted in talk radio for as long as I have. So, you know, it's like, okay, say whatever you want. I don't care. So I don't care about language so much. I don't like people being abusive to each other on my page. You know, it's like, if you guys want to go fight, go out in the alley and fight. You know, just keep it off my page. I don't like that shit. But the one real hard and fast rule that I have is don't bore me. If you bore me and you constantly poke at me with boring things, I will make you go away. And that's what I had to do to this guy, because now I know this will sound crazy, but it all started with a conspiracy theory. And this guy said, you know, you ought to have this guy on your show. And I didn't know who it was, and I looked him up, and he was one of these wacko Sandy Hook never happened, you know, conspiracy assholes.
Jesus.
And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't put crazy shit on my show. And then he started posting up all of the reasons why it wasn't crazy. Now, Rob, I know you're aware of this, and I don't know how many of the people who listen to us every week are aware of this. Where do all conspiracy theories end up?
Oh, you want me to say it?
Yes, I do.
The guys who run the Hollywood and the banks.
It's always the Jews. It doesn't matter what the conspiracy theory is. So I already knew what this guy was. You know, I already knew as soon as he started, you should have this Sandy Hook denier on your show. I was like, oh, you're one of those assholes. So it took about 4 or 5 days for him to finally get around to it. You know, it's not just any Jews. It's the Zionist Jews. And I was like, oh, shit. All right. That's it. You're boring. Go away. And
tell me who is when we're off the air so I can find him and kill him.
Okay.
See, this is what Zionist Jews do. We very quietly and surreptitiously sneak in and have somebody finish you off, usually a Russian.
Yeah. You know,
Russians fear anything and they'll take the money.
My favorite part, I love it when somebody points out the obvious thing, because my whole shtick on conspiracy theories is there's always one glaringly obvious flaw in all of them, because they're all false. So they hang these open-ended questions with zero evidence on the flimsiest of frameworks. And, you know, there's always one obvious question that you can ask somebody. Like on Sandy Hook, there's about 5 or 6 of them. But there's always one obvious question you can ask somebody that blows the whole thing apart. So the thing that got this guy finally banned is he starts spouting off about how, you know, the Jews have been using the American army that they own and control fully to commit a genocide on the Palestinian people so that they can continue to expand their land and power reach and all of this stuff. And my brother-in-law sent me a private message on Facebook and said, so let me get this straight. The International Zionist Jewish Conspiracy has been at this for 100 years, and they've got a plot of land about the size of Delaware. I was like, yeah, you know?
150% correct. It is the size of Delaware.
So yeah, it's like obviously they are in control of everything because they've got a plot of land the size of Delaware to show for it. Damn, they're good.
Well, that's the Zog for you, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I was just I thought it was interesting because, you know, it's not the only, you know, unfortunately, there's been a lot said about Donald Trump not necessarily foisting this stuff on us because he doesn't really understand any of it, but he gives an open door to these people to show up and start spouting off. And because he's not smart enough to shut any of them down, and he doesn't really have the desire to anyway, because they vote for him. But just to go, you know, just again, to show that this is not something that is relegated to the right or the left, along comes some schmuck by the name of Mark Lamont Hill. And he was a commentator on CNN, and they fired his ass over this stuff because he started doing the same thing, spinning the Palestinians are being treated unfairly and all of this stuff, and it was in a non CNN event, but it was hateful and heinous enough, and enough of a departure from the truth that CNN said, no, I think you're done, go away.
If only we could just start getting rid of more people like that. There was some complete and utter cock gobbler on a friend's page. I don't remember who it was, but he started spouting off about Israel. Now, the one thing you do is don't spell it wrong, and he spelled Israel wrong like three different ways. It's the way you spell Israel. And I decided to just have a little fun at his expense. So I reported him on like several different things for fake name, fake account, posting inappropriate things. It's a fake profile, you know. He's probably Arab or some fucking South American, you know, sympathizer with those people. But here's the fun thing about Facebook, and I told him that you and I would actually talk about this because a mutual friend of ours, the wonderful, glorious Mr. Robbie Rist, yesterday posted that he was going to be listening to Monday by The Jam.
Yes.
And I had to chimp in. Now, he did also throw in there, he goes, next I'll start obsessing over Wednesday week. And I said to him, which one, The Undertones or the Elvis Costello song? And he did say both great. And he's totally right about that. Although, of course, me being an Undertones freak, naturally I'm going to go with that one. But, you know, we started having more of a conversation about sound effects. And he looks at his being their Sergeant Pepper. Of course, it's their Revolver. But I said, you know what? Because we're having this conversation, John Grayson and I will, in fact, talk about sound effects once again, because we can never do it enough.
Right.
On the latest episode of Radio City with John Grayson and Rob Ross, because it's a fine program and we speak knowledgeably. So I decided this morning I was going to listen to that magnificent piece of work. And I can listen to that album. I can go a span of days, weeks, months, years after having played that album, you know, into the white grooves, you know.
Right.
And I listened to it this morning on the ferry ride, and goddamn, if it doesn't still sound fresh and exciting and gets your blood pumping, and, you know, just from the opening slams of Start and going right into Pretty Green Monday, But I'm Different Now, Set the House Ablaze, and That's Entertainment. You want to talk about one of the most perfect side ones ever created by any band anywhere. Side one of Sound Effects was it. You know, and as we now know, it's Weller's favorite Jam album, and rightfully so, because he, you know, he showed that he was a truly gifted songwriter with All Mod Cons. He upped his own game with Setting Suns, with his wordsmithing, but it was Sound Effects where everything came together, the lyrics and the music. There isn't, in my opinion, a bad or weak cut on that album. And I got to admit, listening to the anniversary edition that Polydor put out, I think in 2010, them adding Going Underground, The Dreams of Children, and Liza Radley only made it more perfect.
Right.
You know, I mean, yes, of course, as most people I think are aware, the one thing the Jam didn't do is they stuck to that 60s tradition of not putting singles on the concurrent albums. Very rarely did that happen. You know, Start was the single from the album. A single before the album did not appear, you know. But in this case, you know, they pulled That's Entertainment, and that was the biggest selling import because it charted at number 8, you know?
Yeah.
Sound Effects is one of those albums for the ages. It's like Revolver. It's like The Who's Sellout. It's like number 1 record, you know? It's one of those, it's like Murmur. You have to have it. It's part of a musical education that will broaden your scope.
But think, you know, here's what's great about that is you think about that list of albums that you just ticked off. And what do they all have in common? If you sat people who are musically knowledgeable down and said, what sets these particular albums, like Sell Out and the rest of them, apart from the rest of those bands' catalogs, you would start to hear terms like, they were ballsy. You know, that those albums had more balls to them.
They were also all very intelligent albums. They were smart records.
Right.
None of them were lightweights. None of them were fluffy. None of them were cutesy pop, you know. Yeah, there was pop in them, but there was pop with thought, hard work.
Yeah.
Intensity, raw gut emotion.
But, you know, you look at a song like Pretty Green, though, and how does it start? Does it start, you know, like a regular standard issue pop song or even a power pop song? No. What does it do? Hits you in the face with a bass.
Yeah, a funk bass.
Boom.
with a kind of roundabout disco rhythm.
Right.
I've got a bucket full of Pretty Green. I'm going to put it in my fruit machine. I'm going to put it in my jukebox.
Writing the hi-hats for the drum pad. Yeah, I mean, it's an album that 38 years after I first heard it, and I am still amazed by it, and still can get the chills from it. But also, the fact is that album is the singular album that truly changed my life. Yes, Revolver was my awakening. Sellout was what pushed me to become a guitar player. But Sound Effects is the album that made me become me, because it made me want to be a songwriter like Paul Weller, because he wasn't that far apart from me age-wise, and I understood what he was talking about. So that whole thing about, well, they were too British, I never bought that, because I understood perfectly every single thing Weller always said.
Yeah.
It isn't hard to do.
Right. And as a lifelong Kinks fan, and you know, it's funny because you started this conversation referencing Robbie Rist. I put up a lyric from a Kinks song the other day, and he said, best band of the 60s. And he goes, yeah, I said it. The thing is, as a lifelong fan and as somebody who does, you know, breathe them in the same breath with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, then, you know, you ticked off the songs on side one. You take a look at a song like Man in the Corner Shop on side two and tell me that doesn't draw some serious DNA from the songwriting styles of Ray Davies.
Of course. And lest we should forget, let's go back two albums to Almod Khan's.
Right.
What was the single right before it? David Watts.
Yep.
You know, there is a version of The Jam doing Dead End Street, which isn't great, but hey, you know, look, Ray Davies, as far as I'm concerned, should be the poet laureate.
Right.
I mean, there's really no question about it. Weller always said his two biggest influences, songwriting-wise, were Ray Davies and Steve Marriott.
Yep.
You really can't go wrong on either front. But the fact is, Ray Davies was Paul Weller's teacher, as Paul Weller was my teacher.
Right.
That's how I look at it.
It is. It's an incredible piece of work. I mean, you're right. I mean, Sound Effects is, in fact, their apex. When it comes to creativity, when it comes to music, when it comes to songwriting and completion of everything, of every thought on the album, Sound Effects is better than any of them.
It will always be one of the great marvels and wonders of life that I got to experience it when it came out and was just so taken by it that I let it guide me,
yeah.
You know, and I'm thankful for that. And I will always be eternally grateful to Paul Weller and Bruce Foxton and Rick Buckler for that, because that album is what every young musician should aspire to.
No doubt.
That's how I look at it.
Yep, and
because it was created by a guy who was at that time 22 years old.
And as a 49-year-old, that just hurts. But I know exactly what you mean. But, you know, there is something we also need to make mention of before we take our leave, because we had a little bit of discussion at the beginning of this show about the loss of George Herbert Walker Bush, the other name that we lost just over these last few days. And I have to admit that for whatever reason, the one TV show that always kind of eluded me, and I don't mean I didn't get it, because when I finally did get around to watching it, I absolutely loved it. But the one that when I was a kid was never on when I was watching TV was F Troop. Everybody else got F Troop at a time that made sense for them to sit down and watch it. And I got Gomer Pyle and Mayberry RFD and all that crap. And F Troop was just not around in my after school hours on WTOG channel 44 when I was a kid. So, the loss of Ken Berry, to me, it's a lot of the peripheral stuff. I mean, certainly the work on F Troop was fantastic, but it's all of the other stuff that he did that I started thinking about when the word came down that he was gone. I think he was 85 years old, right?
Yes.
And it's genius stuff. He was always so much fun to watch. He was one of those guys who, he wasn't a slapstick physical comedian necessarily, but he could do it. And he understood the physicality of comedy better than most people do.
He was very much like Tim Conway.
Yes, right.
Except he was much more physical about it, because certainly on F Troop, his thing was to be the straight man, but always do the pratfalls.
Yep.
You know, because he was playing the sort of well-meaning, dim-witted leader to the likes of Forrest Tucker and Larry Storch.
Right.
Because they were the stars of the show. But he was an intricate – he was an integral part for that to be able to work, because he was never the – he wasn't like – I know I'm drawing McHale's Navy comparisons here, but whenever Quentin McHale would always come up with some kind of scheme – or scam, as it were.
Right.
Joe Flynn's character was always the one to stand there admonishing him and wagging the finger. whereas Ken Barry's Captain Parmenter was always the guy who was like, well, if you got to do it, But, it wasn't just that. He was also really affable in replacing somebody like Andy Griffith when Andy Griffith segued out of The Andy Griffith Show and the show became Mayberry RFD. He was the perfect replacement. But he was also a great song and dance man too.
Yeah.
He was an all around entertainer. And I think he very often gets overlooked, as so many of those wonderful talents that we did grow up with are unfortunately overlooked. And I was lucky. I got to watch F Troop. Usually if I was home from school sick at around 9:30, 10 o'clock on channel 11, right after Gomer Pyle.
Yep.
See.
Right. Well, and the interesting thing about Ken Berry is that, much like what Disney did at the time with Dean Jones, they had to make him goofier looking than he actually was. They did the same thing with Lucille Ball. I mean, Lucille Ball on the I Love Lucy show is wearing effectively clown makeup, because she was very pretty in her earlier iteration. When she was being a model and an actress, she was gorgeous. And guys like Ken Berry and Dean Jones were classically good looking guys, but they were doing comedy, so they always made the makeup make them look a little weird, a little off. And, it's just one of those things to look for when you look at a guy like, nobody says, who's a good-looking actor? Oh, that Ken Berry guy. But, it's all because of the costumes and the makeup that they put those guys in.
Absolutely correct. Well, so they resume with a bang and a boom, F Troop.
And where the heck are we anyway? That said, is there anything else you want to hit before we get to In Our Heads for this week?
I'd like to hit Henrik Lundqvist with a hockey stick upside the head.
Oh. Is that?
Yeah. I don't want to veer into any more sports talk, because I'm still trying to deal with the fact that the New York Mets have already blown the season. I'm sorry. This season is going to be shit.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm going to say. Look it up. Big trade, big fuck up. New general manager trying to play new sheriff in town. No, I already hate you. End of story.
There's something that occurred to me yesterday as we get into the In Our Heads segment that it when I thought about it, it made me laugh, because in the situation that I find myself in right now, and there is movement on the job front. I will be, by the way, The week of December 17th, if you're listening into this, then check out from 6 to 9 in the evening Central Time. So that'd be 7 to 10 Eastern. I'll be on KMBZ, which is an FM talk station in Kansas City. I mentioned, I think, a couple of weeks ago, I did some fill-in there. I'll be doing another week for them on the 17th of this month. So if you want to listen in and call in and whatever, they have an online, they're on the radio.com app on the cell phones, and they're also, they're just on their website. You can listen live on that as well. But as I was going through all of this and dealing with everything that you deal with when you lose a job, you know, the unemployment filings and all of that stuff that you can now do online, you used to have to go there and do. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things that always reminds you. It's like, wow, working really is the preferable way to go to all of this. You know, and you're watching everything kind of dwindle away and thinking, how are we going to navigate all this stuff? And what started happening is that every sad sack, down and out song that I've ever heard in my life started rolling through my head. And I realized that was really the line of demarcation. That's when pop music shifted from jazz-influenced pop to blues-influenced pop, was during the Depression era, for obvious reasons. And you went from songs like We're in the Money in the jazz age to songs like, you know, the every blues song you've ever heard about being broke and all of that stuff. And that started, that's where the edge that rock and roll has came from, is directly related to those blues songs in the 40s and 50s. So there's so many of those things that I have as songs that I always loved through my entire life that are nothing more than just everything is gone, I have nothing, you know. So I figured we'd talk about some of those and just kind of goof around with it for a while. What kind of down and out, I'm broke songs do you love more than any others?
Oh, well, when it happens to me when I lose a job, I automatically start singing No Bob. No. I go for the spirituals, you know?
Yep.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Glory, hallelujah.
That's a good question. Down in, you know,
because I'll tell you, the first one that popped into my head, the one that started playing while I was going through this, was Ray Charles singing I'm Busted.
I got a cow that went by and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings.
Well, you know, actually, I try to look at it with a sense of humor because I know I'm going to lose my shit sooner than later. But, you know, in the more modern era, every time I lose a job, the first thing that comes out of my mouth was, I was sitting, what was it? I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable hour. But heaven knows I'm miserable now. I don't think about the down and out sort of songs when I've been in a state of unemployment, mainly because I'm always frustrated by work.
Yeah.
I think if I was going to listen to down and out songs, it's more like when a relationship turns into shit.
Sure.
Then I really go for the bleakest. And no, I don't mean Joy Division or The Cure. I don't, you know, I'm not that much of an asshole. You know, when I get really down, I listen to a lot of like the 50s stuff too. I listen to a lot of Elvis, the more negative things like One Sided Love Affair and shit like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
My Baby Left Me, which is basically a rewrite of That's All Right, Mama.
But I stand at my window, wring my hands and cry. I hate to lose that woman, hate to say goodbye. You know she left me. Yes, she left me. My baby even left me, never said a word.
That's a really good question. It's hard. I'll probably come up with all the answers once we hang up.
Well, see, and there's so many out there. I mean, as far as the monetary side of things, you look at the bands that came from nothing. And, I mean, certainly. Yeah, I mean, a lot of them did. Yeah, I mean, the Beatles, for that matter, did. And so did the Hollies. You know, all of those guys were flat broke and grew out of that world and all of a sudden made a ton of money. But, you know, the ones who really got it, and again, lifelong fan of Eric Burdon, and you listen to a song like We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and the desperation that's in that song, that, you know, permeates through a lot of the Springsteen stuff from the early days, from Thunder Road and all of that. And that song, to me, it wrote about so much by saying relatively little, you know, but you really got exactly how desperate that situation was that whoever was singing that song was singing about.
Well, the thing is, a lot of those songs are songs of experience, really.
Yep.
That's what it boils down to. And when you've had the experience, you know, The Animals were from Newcastle, and that was about as bleak as you could get.
Right.
You know, songs like We Gotta Get Out of This Place, or It's My Life, or Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. I mean, that's a hell of a trilogy.
Yep.
You know? The Hollies, you know, it's funny. They always had the most, I would say, cheerful spin on things, if you think about it. Their songs were not what I would call a bleak nature.
No, and it's funny because of where they came from. You know, songs like Bus Stop, that's very upper class London.
Graham Gouldman. Yeah, that's Graham Gouldman at his best. But I mean, still, you know, the Hollies, you know, if you want to talk about an original composition, Stop, Stop, Stop is hilarious.
Right.
You know, because it's about this drunk who keeps putting his hands on a dancer in a club. And mind you, these guys can't, you know, they weren't exactly in the money. They weren't flush. They were the Hollies were probably the last of the British beat bands that tasted success, if you think about it.
Yep.
I mean, Look Through Any Window, which was also written by Graham Gouldman, that was a peripheral hit. It was their first foray into the American top 40, I think. But then Bus Stop was huge. And that was 66.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's very late in the game. You know, Herman's – I prefer actually – I think about it. If I lose a job then or leave a job, I prefer to listen to the more – I will listen to Herman's Hermits probably more than I would listen to something more serious, you know. I'll probably go for a lighter touch to keep my spirits afloat, to be honest with you, because I need something to buoy me up rather than to keep me mired in the, oh, God, I'm in this horribly nebulous state right now. I don't know what I'm going to do next. You know, because when you've had the carpet pulled out from underneath your feet, you really don't know where to go. It's frightening. It's daunting. And I don't want the added misery lumped onto me by something that I love like music to bring me down even further.
Yeah, it's funny because I do. I go exactly the opposite direction with it. And, that, you know, another one of the ones that occurred to me, and in fact, it's the one that I posted that Robbie Rist ended up commenting on. It was a song from Lola versus Power Man called Get Back in the Line. And it's about a guy who is a day laborer who's wondering if he's going to get picked to work that day so that he can bring home a bottle of wine for his wife, you know, at the end of the day. And it's that kind of thing. Maybe it's just that it reminds me things aren't that bad.
Now I think of what my mama told me. She always said that it would never, ever work out. But all I want to do is make some money.
The other one, and I'll leave you with this one, and then you can add on whatever you want afterward. But the song that again, I probably was 6 or 7 years old the first time I heard it, No Woman, No Cry by Bob Marley. There's a couple of lines in that song where he talks about being there with his friends in the government yard in Trenchtown. Now, Trenchtown is Jamaica's version of Newcastle. You know, it's as desperate as it gets. There is no money there. Everything is ramshackle shanties and all of this stuff. And so here's this guy singing this beautiful song about being there with his friends and having nothing to eat but cornmeal porridge. And yet they're all sitting around and singing songs and being happy. And it's like, damn, you know, again, if that's what life was like and somebody that's got that kind of energy and that kind of positive outlook can come out of that environment, I have nothing to bitch about.
Well, it's a case of we are programmed when we're younger and we assume the mantle of responsibility as we get older to like structure in our lives.
Yep.
You know, at least if we're rational beings, because I will tell you, and I'm not being funny when I say this, I look at millennials and they have absolutely no sense of responsibility, no sense of structure, no sense of anything tangible for the long term. Everything with them is short-term gains rather than long-term goals.
Right.
You know? So when your routine, when your set routine that keeps the balance of your life moving, you know, like a steady job and an income and a place to go every day, when that's upended, it is a very, very difficult thing to cope with. And rational beings who can cope with it usually wind up, you know, we spin our wheels for a little bit, like it's just natural. You have no choice when you're trying to find that footing those first few days afterwards. But then it starts to get better. It does.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so, yeah, we're still in that fun part of it where it's all about the opportunities and all about looking forward to what the next steps are going to be. So we'll continue to keep you posted on that. But Rob,
you just said the magic word, looking forward.
Yeah. You know? Right.
Because that's what it's all about. It's always moving forward, onward and upward.
Rob Ross, good words, my man. Thank you so much. And we'll do this all again next week.
Well, thank you, Brother John. And to our listeners, thank you all very much. And we will definitely see you next week with more good stuff.